this week on Art on the Air features self-taught artist D. Lammy Hansen, whose ever customary form of painting plus the use of 15th century technique of silver and middle point. Next, returning to Art on the Air is photographer George Castle, whose new work explores man-altered landscapes. Our spotlight is on South Shore Art's new exhibit, Sense and Sensibility, Poetry and Painting.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM and WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available on our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our shows are available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for more information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight. He's the guest curator, along with his wife, Linda Norman, Tom Torlimke. And he's going to talk about a unique exhibit they have that brings in great ideas and everything. And they just finished their exhibit earlier, the This Is It exhibit, and he might talk a little bit about it. It's called Sense and Sensibility, Poetry and Painting. Tom, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Hi. Aloha. Thanks. Hey, thanks for having me, Larry and Esther. It's so nice to see you.
It's really good to see you.
Good to see you too, Tom. Well, you know, before we get into the new exhibit, that was an exciting one. This Is It was a great exhibit. I know I was trying to get over there the night of that you had the reception with all the artists and you had some other things. So just tell us briefly, touch back on that, and then we'll move on.
Oh, yeah. Wow. It was just fantastic. All of these great documentary and journalistic photographers were there, like the cream of the crop. It was just fantastic. And all these guys and women, these photographers, they all like respect one another, and they brought out a really big crowd. We had people from the New York Times came, Washington Post. We had all these people coming out to see these fantastic photographers. And the stories, you know, I was thinking at first the stories were a little bit, super heavy about life and people and stuff, and thinking, oh, maybe we won't get a good turnout. But everybody wanted to see this stuff. And such important work that everybody like is welcome into those people's lives that they documented. It was just fantastic.
Yeah, we were privileged to have two of the photographers on, John Lowenstein, Mariah Carson, and they really gave us some insights into that.
Yeah, it's just how much of their life they devote and dedicate to visiting these stories that they're after is amazing. Some of them last years and years of these photographers engendering trust from those people and getting in their community and then taking really poignant, important pictures that tell the truth.
Well, after only speaking with them for such a short time, you could feel the heart and soul of both of them, and it really shows in their work.
Yeah, I agree.
One of the questions I have before you tell us about the exhibit is how both you and Linda got brought in to be be the curators there real quick, and then let's talk about the new exhibit.
Well, I think, you know, we go to the events there, and we were at an event, and we were talking to John Kane, and he was talking about, you know, stepping down and stuff, and he was getting really worried about that. And we had been mulling this around for a while that we really miss doing even though we do projects and shows, us together organizing things, it's not the same as having like an institution behind you where you can, you know you're going to be able to do some incredible stuff because of funding and all of that stuff. So when we were talking to John Kane, we were like, you know, we should throw our hat in the ring. We should try to see if if they go for us doing this, because we'd get so much out of it and they would get so much out of it, that's providing we would do a good job or not. And then that's how it happened.
Very good. And of course, that's Linda's old stomping grounds. When I worked at the center there in the theater, she was there also. So it's kind of bringing her back to her old game. So tell us about this new exhibit.
So this new exhibit, you know, Sense and Sensibility, Poetry and Painting, is like, it's a thing that is like close to my heart. It's been rolling around in my head for a while, you know. It's the greatest art, I think. Going to all the museums, going to all the exhibits and stuff, I would walk into looking at all of this art and be like, wow, you know, I've seen this painting, whatever, 70 times, and it still has something new for me. What is it that keeps drawing me to this painting, you know? And it's like, it's indescribable. The communication of visual art through people's minds is indescribable. And it's a lot like poetry. The artists and the poets, it seems as though they have like their eyeballs are made of like mirror inside their head. They can see, reflect what's inside them and what's outside them. They can reflect that at the same time while they're painting, while they're interacting with life. And then whatever's on the canvas is like, it's mysterious, but yet it's familiar, because really it's about life. So we've all seen it in one form or another. So then it's got two and three different lives, the lives of the artists that they saw, the things outside, the things inside. And then the people have the same baggage or content in their head when they look at the work. So everybody sees something different. So that's how it started.
It's, you know, you're so right about that, because you can have one artist's body of work and then there's that one piece out of 70 pieces that just really calls to you over and over again as well. So it's just amazing, those moments. So, you know, like the, when you said poetry and painting, it had me wondering whether these pieces included text in them in some sort of way or...
No, not really. I mean, okay. I don't think anybody puts text in there. It's mostly symbolic idea that poetry is like not all what, when you read it, it's stacked with other stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have about a minute left. So, Tom, tell us about some of the things going on and with it. Tell us about the dates of the show and real quickly.
Yeah. So I'll tell you about the artists. So the artists are Bradley Biancardi, Ellen Green, Tyru Slang Jones, Nina Rizzo, William Staples, Ann Toby, Pedro Velez, and Gabriel Villa. The opening reception is Thursday, January 26th, 5 to 8 p.m. And then we got some additional programming right away that weekend. Right after that, there's an artist panel discussion Saturday, January 28th at 2 p.m. And it's just fantastic. You're going to be like just mesmerized by these paintings. These paintings are like, they're out of this world. They're mystical. They're poetic. They're like psychological. They're moving and they're familiar, but yet they're not familiar. There's nature.
You have me totally intrigued.
Yeah.
Well, we have to wrap it up there, Tom. Thank you so much for coming to Art in the Air Spotlight. That's the new exhibit at South Shore Arts, Sense and Sensibility, Poetry and Painting. And it opens on opening receptions January 26th, running through March 24th. Thank you for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the full one-hour Art on the Air program on Lakeshore Public Radio is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome D. Lammy Hansen to Art on the Air. Lammy is an award-winning Chicago-based autodidactic painter, Metal Point visual artist, and author. She is known for dedicating her series of works to emphasizing the psyche of the individual soul. Her subjects invoke a yearning to communicate their personal story through their physical features in many exhibits around the world. Thank you, Lammy, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome. This is so exciting.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're excited to have you on, and a pleasure to get to meet you. And we want you to, our audience, to find out a little bit about you, Lammy, in terms of your background and everything, like your whole origin story. How I like to say it is how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about Lammy.
Born and raised in Harlem. Even though Harlem had such a rich history, you know, the Renaissance thing, I didn't feel as comfortable as being an artist in Harlem. And I would, like I said, I was born and raised, so pretty much the whole time was all Catholic, you know, raising. At the time I was going to school, I actually was getting graded going to church. And I would sit there and stare at all of the, the statues and stuff like that, wondering how that was made. It was also a great way not to fall asleep when you're on your knees. But anyway, the other thing is that I went to school in Albany. Well, I went to Catholic school. I went to Catholic school downtown, and I met another person who was an artist, but I didn't want to compete with her. So I shut down my creativity and just lived, you know, just was a teenager. It wasn't until I got to college that I actually started doing it again as a therapeutic catharsis thing, when I would have moments of or bouts of depression. And then when I became a professional artist, when I graduated and moved back to the city, sold my first painting in Manhattan at this place called Downtown Beirut. It was in the village, and it was the best $150 I ever received, because it was the first painting I ever sold. Wow. But the weirdest thing is, I wish I didn't sell that, because it was one of my pride and joys.
What was the subject matter?
It was actually a black and white with red lips of Lisa Bonet.
Oh.
And the thing is, remember I was telling you about how, you know, using art as a catharsis, I saw a lot of sadness in her eyes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we have this tendency of equating a woman's beauty with her sadness. You know, like, she has to be so beautifully sad, you know. But anyway, I moved to Brooklyn, and I started this art group called South of the Navy Yard Artists. And it was a way to have artists in the community be recognized, instead of always thinking that they needed to be in Manhattan to be a justified artist. Just be an artist wherever you live. And then I ended up moving out of New York, you know, when everything went bust in 2008. I moved to Atlanta briefly, and 3 years, to help take care of my mother. And then I discovered New Orleans, because it wasn't that far away. And I ended up living in New Orleans for 8 years. And that's when I started to really love doing artwork. In such a way that, you know, because you had so many people who were individuals in New Orleans, and I could appreciate that, where in Atlanta, it felt like hive-minded. You understand what I mean?
It's yes,
like you couldn't
completely.
Be an individual.
Yes.
You couldn't be an individual. And it's probably different now, but when I was there, it was, get me the hell out of here. Then in New Orleans, I saw so much creativity, but there's a whole nother way that they would do things, which is you're either born there, you're raised there, you're related to someone there, you go to school there. And I was just strictly Northern girl. But it took me about 8 years to feel as though I got some creed. But at that time, I was on my way out the door coming to Chicago.
What do you think? How do you think that New Orleans, because it's so seeped in history and spirituality.
That's the beautiful thing about New Orleans. There's so much history locked into New Orleans that's actually relative to everything that's American. You don't know it until you live there. And so you can appreciate, number one, you can appreciate the music, you can appreciate the art, you can appreciate the culture, as well as huge amount of history. And that is really what made me fall in love with the way I fell in love with Brooklyn, because of, you know, me being from New York. New York has its own history, per se. But at the end of the day, I still kind of felt like an outsider. And there are some beautiful, warm people there, but I still felt like an outsider because I wanted to maintain my own identity, my individuality. I wouldn't paint streetcars. I wouldn't paint shotgun houses, you know. So, you know, that being said, I think, you know, they have an amazing group of artists down there anyway who were born and raised there. So, you know, for me, I'm like, go shine, you know. That's the basic thing. But when I came, I'm going to say this. In 2017, I went to Spain to do a artist residency. It was in Barcelona. That's where I learned how to do the metal point that you see me do now. I pretty much self-taught myself with the aid of my husband. And we were like in the vineyards, like, trying to find the best way to make charcoal. We made it out of sugar. We made it out of tree bark, all kind of tree bark. We finally did it out of the wine vines. And that was the one way that I could actually get the silver to adhere to the paper. Then when we came back, I started doing all other methods to try and get the silver to stick. I finally found the perfect black. And I said this earlier, I said, it's the blackety black of the black. because it is 99% light absorption. And it's by a guy named Stuart. Simple. And he hates Anish Kapoor. You know the artist?
Yes, yes.
He hates him because Anish had a similar product and he sold it to the government, I think. And
oh, did he put some sort of copyright on it that he was the only one able to use it?
And he didn't make it available for the consumer, the artist. So when I discovered this art, this paint, I was just like, oh, finally, I can actually do more depth, you know? And so I've been in love with it. And that's what I've been using in the last 2 years. It's really expensive, but it gives me such great rewards later. You know, I can really work on it. And boy, it's like one of those things. But, you know, so that was my journey. And I ended up here in Chicago. And it's not New York, but let me tell you, I'm in love with it. I'm in love with I have my cityscape that I need to thrive, you know, like that energy.
Right.
I don't know what it is, but once you're here, it's like, oh, I can breathe again. I don't know why. I just can't. Plus, I'm near water and I need to be near water.
Yes.
And I think that's why I wasn't too happy with Atlanta, because I was like, where's the water? I was like, you guys need water, you know, but so in Chicago, I'm really, really loving being here.
Lami, I was going to have you describe, maybe a little earlier, but I mean, of course, this is a radio show, but maybe describe your artwork, your themes and everything. I know one thing I came across is like you have a whole series of women that are painted with only one eye and the other one's shaded or something like that. But yeah. To describe some of the different variations of things that you do.
Well, there's a few series I have. The one that you just described is called the One Eye Tulip, which is one eye tulips. Mm-hmm. And it's that is more on the therapeutic catharsis side of womanhood. And that is more about the fact that women have been, I'm going to say it like this. When I was a kid, I was always told, and I don't know if it was the Catholic thing or if it was the child thing, but children should be seen and not heard. Over the course of a person's life, if that is said to them time and time again, they lose their voice. They lose to express themselves, per se. They're not able to defend themselves or express themselves in the proper way. That has nothing to do with violence. It's almost a counter thing to do. So when I had the one-eyed tulips, it's more like showing the emotional side of a woman who really has so much to say. And the lips, if you notice, they're full.
Right.
Lips. And it's, I see it as full of words that have not been spoken.
And this was, did you create this work in New Orleans?
Actually, I was creating it from Atlanta to New Orleans. Mm. And I haven't done anything, to tell you the truth, because you met me, I guess, through Gally Gishard.
Andre.
Yeah.
Andre Francis.
And they're the last ones who have had that. I have no more big one-eyed tulips. So then while I was in New Orleans, because remember, rich history, I created the Beauty Beyond the Brown Paper Bag Test. Have you ever heard of the Brown Paper Bag Test?
No.
Okay. Okay. In the South, in most, let's say, Black cultures, African-American cultures, at the turn of the century, around 1912 or 1916, certain churches, sororities, fraternities, social gatherings, would actually have a brown paper bag at the entrance of certain, you know, functions. And if you were darker than the brown paper bag, you were not allowed in. If you were lighter, then you were allowed in. Mm-hmm. And it also goes to the Blue Vein Society. If you can show that you have blue veins, they'll let you in. But if you don't, you're not considered good. So I created in New Orleans. And the thing is that there's a certain psyche that I kept getting when I was there. They would say that to each other. I didn't really like it because it made me think that if you're saying that to someone like, oh, I thought you were brown paper bagging me, that made me think that, oh, so you're telling that person that they're actually treating you bad. No, you don't do that. You know, you always bring the up game. You don't bring the low game. But everybody operates on the low game as a self-deprecation, yeah, deprecation kind of thing. So I made the two big kind of tapestries. One is made of 150 brown paper bags, and the other one is 95. And they are of women, dark skin, beautiful women who basically, one was actually called A Lady Ahead Above. And in the brown paper bag, you see a line like right where her head is. And that means her head is above that black line that's trying to keep her down. Most people in New Orleans assumed that that was her having her head above the water because, you know, they always have issues in history with the hurricanes and the water and the flooding.
Sure.
But it was actually me saying, this black line is not keeping me down. That was my version. And another one was showing a very ethnic, beautiful, very kind of African-esque kind of woman. Her head is held up high and she just looks so beautifully regal. And that is the brown paper bag. And then when I came back from, I'm going to go back a little. Right before the one-eyed tulip, there was also the transcendent series, which is people are allowed to grow into the people who they're supposed to be, who they should be. And so you see them emerging from different, you know, like series of colors and stuff. And then you see them come out. And a friend of mine actually used that book for a trans story that she wrote about a woman who is now a man, but that was the person that she was supposed to be. So it's on the cover of her book.
So what is the medium? What medium are you using for
that? That was all, everything at that point was all acrylic. And oil. And yeah, acrylic oil. And with the brown paper bags, it was acrylic oil and ink.
Okay.
And then in 2017, when I started doing Metal Point, I was so much in love with it. And I ended up doing a really, it was called A Portrait of His Beautiful Blackness. And it was acrylic over plaster, over and then grinding in charcoal. So when you see his skin, it looks, and it's a, of a man and his torso. And when you see his skin, it looks like it's been punctured and this, that. And it kind of reminds me of slavery and the way the black man had been beaten and stuff like that.
Or
gunshot. Yes. Like right now, it would be considered like either knife marks and gunshot. Kind of, it kind of looks like that. That was actually accepted into a show at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art for a show, and it was like the best feeling ever to actually be in that show. And then the other parts of the silver points that I did in Spain actually ended up getting a show at the George Washington Carver Interpretive Museum in Dothan, Alabama. That was the show that actually kept me continuing to do this. And the reason why is because it was done on Mother's Day. And Mother's Day was the day that I was able to do a presentation to a room full of women who never saw artwork like that. But then at the end of my whole presentation, women from 40 to 80 came up to me and they said, "You just made me think about what I consider beautiful about black skin or myself or this, that, and the other." And that made me go, I have to keep doing this.
Yeah.
Because
your work is, it really is so transporting. And I mean, I feel myself in those paintings, you know.
I did my job. Thank
yeah,
you.
It's just so beautiful. Like your divinity, Divinity in the Blue is Divinity in the Blue.
Divinity in the Blue.
It's just
that's the other show. And
it's so interesting because I saw that title and right away I thought, I did not think of blues as being the blues. I really thought of blue because in even historically, I mean like medieval almost, that blue was the most expensive color in the world, that lapis that they ground
right
up. And
that.
And it was saved for like Mary's garments. And so
that is the reason every single woman that you see that's blue in that show, that's a Mary.
I was going to ask you about, you know, the technique of a silver point, metal point is kind of an ancient. Can you describe that? It goes back to the 15th century. Tell us a little bit about what it is.
It's 15th century silver point. It was actually used by the medieval Renaissance Gothic scribes, and they actually wrote in it. And it predates pencil, not so much clay, but it predates pencil and ink. And the reason why it's not, you know, prevalent as ink isn't because ink actually came and kind of stole the fever of that. But it is, you're taking a fine, a fine wire, and you're actually drawing with it or signing with it or whatever. Remember, everybody was writing. There was no typewriters or anything like that. So they had to go over and over and over again. But, you know, as time went on, silver would get dark. They would only use it on light surfaces. And the one reason that really drew my passion is because, remember, I was telling you, you know, Catholic school, and then at one point I discovered Da Vinci, and I've been in love with Leonardo.
Yeah.
And just his genius. And then I, you know, I saw how gorgeous, how delicate, how exquisite it was to see. If you really look at the work from that period, how delicate it was. So in my mind, I thought, wouldn't it be nice to actually change the narrative of the how people view black people in with a technique that shows delicacy, that shows exquisiteness, and show like a level of elegance. And that's what kind of turned me onto it. And it's really drawing with a simple wire. And it's time consuming. This piece here took me 7 months to do.
Yeah.
And I do it on black. But if I did it on white, God, I think I'd only get one done, you know, and they're huge. It's huge.
Well, how did that transpire? Because didn't you say that was like, this is going to be probably the largest silver point
And the reason why it's going to be the largest is because nobody works this big.
Right.
Nobody works this. I mean, there's one big silver point. It's at the Art Institute of Chicago. The artist's name is John Wild, and it was an autobiography kind of thing. The reason why I'm doing it this way, it's kind of autobiographical in a way, but Chicago architecture reminded me of my architecture in New York. Okay, and that's another warm feeling I get when I'm walking in around Chicago. But there's an artist, her name is like Dorothy Burge. She's in the residency that I'm in. She's a quilter, and she's like a kind of like a master quilter. And she actually incorporates her family in the quilt. And I thought to myself, you know what? I think I want to put my family, you know, I want to do something, you know, just to give them some sort of relevance, you know, instead of just doing the traditional portrait, create something that would actually be something that other people could actually associate with. Because right. There are times in Harlem that was so beautiful. And what I'm trying to do here is that, number one, I'm trying to show that in a Black neighborhood, you can actually have normal life. And it doesn't necessarily have guns or a pimp on the corner or a hoe over there, that children are actually on the street being children, you know, mothers and their kids. And, you know, that's the one I remember when I was growing up. So at a certain point, I just care more about just getting that information out to people. But if you want me to wrap up, I can actually just do it this way, which is, if you want to see more, you can always come go to dlammyhanson.com, and you can actually read the articles and the artwork that I have, and the rest.
And where is it opening? It's opening on.
It's opening at the Chicago Art Department. You're only seeing a brief of it, but it's opening at the Chicago Art Department in Chicago, which is 1926 South Halsted Street. The opening is going to be January 13th from 6 to 10. And that is actually in Pilsen, which is their second Friday event that they do. And it's going to be the second Friday of January.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art of the Year and sharing your artwork, your journey and everything. Dlammy Hanson, and you can see her website if you go to our webpage, but dlammyhanson.com, and see your exhibit opening on the 13th of January. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Oh, gosh.
Thank you so much.
Thank
it was
you.
A pleasure.
Extreme pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome George Castle to Art on the Air. George is an award-winning photographer who has participated in numerous exhibits for over 30 years. He has been interested in photography since he was 8 years old. He refers to himself as a walking around photographer. George often works on photographic projects based on the natural or man-altered landscape. Thank you, George, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome. It's so terrific to see you.
Well, hello, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, we like having you on, George. Well, our audience, and I know you were on in March of 2019 when we were still doing these in the studio, but now we finally catch up. And also, we're going to talk about your newer work that you're on the man-altered landscapes and images and things like that. But what we want to first talk about is you, and give us your background, kind of your whole biography, resume, and everything. And I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about yourself.
Well, that'd be a long story, but highlights are...
We like long stories.
Do you? Well, I grew up mainly in a suburb of Milwaukee called Wauwatosa, is the name of the town. It's just on the west side. And when I went to junior high school there, Hawthorne Junior High School, I think it was called, they had a contest. They needed a photographer for the school newspaper. So... I entered the contest just on a whim. I was interested in photography, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And I just submitted some pictures, and lo and behold, that started me out.
What kind of camera did you use back then? Well, just jump in for a second.
You know, I think I had a Kodak. Pony 4, an old 35 millimeter fixed lens, 35 millimeter camera. There was, you know, there wasn't anything fancy at all.
Okay.
But it's what I had, you know.
So then the story continues from there.
Yeah. So then later on, when I went into high school, I also got involved in the school newspaper there. And they wanted me to do these shots and stuff. And they gave me this camera to use, a huge box.
Oh, my God.
It's like 3 foot long and a foot wide and about 2 feet deep. And I opened it up, and there was an old Graflex Speed Graphic 4x5 camera, you know, with the film holders that go in the back and the whole thing. And they said, here it is, with no instructions. So I just kind of improvised. I started using it, and I went on with it. And I got to like it a lot, really. But it was kind of a big and clunky thing to carry around. I remember carrying it home on the school bus and all that kind of stuff. And then later on, the high school, which was Wauwatosa High School, split into two halves, Wauwatosa East and Wauwatosa West. And where I lived moved me to Wauwatosa West, which was the new school. So I started working out there also in the yearbook and the paper and taking pictures at sports events and one thing or another and, you know, kept going. And then later on, I went to college. I went to University of Wisconsin at Platteville, Wisconsin, which is in the southwest corner of the state. It's about 20 miles from Dubuque, Iowa. And my interest was actually geology at that time. And I wound up getting my degree in geology and spent, you know, 20 more years as a geologist, working as a geologist. But while I was there, I got involved in taking pictures for an engineering technical magazine called The Geode. And was involved with mining groups, and we'd go on trips and visit these mines, and I'd be taking all these pictures. So I did that for a number of years, plus taking pictures of, you know, just events for friends and whatever. And I was involved with a cave exploring group, and I got interested in taking pictures underground in caves, which was a whole challenge in itself. But I was kind of like...
So at that point, what camera were you using? Certainly not the big box.
No. I had to leave that back at Wauwatosa High School. They wouldn't let me take that. You know, I think I had something called a Mamiya 35 millimeter camera. I forget the model, but it had both. It had a regular average metering and spot metering built into it, I remember, on the dial, which was interesting to me. I never, you know, worked with that before. And with different kinds of flash arrangements, I improvised a ammo box, a 50 caliber ammo box with foam pads inside, and could carry my gear, my camera in there with flash and everything. And and I used that to drag it into the cave, because they were often, you know, you often had to use ropes to get in or crawl through mud or one thing or another, and I just couldn't have it hanging around my neck. So I got doing that and taking pictures of the group, and I was with rode a motorcycle at that time, so I was taking pictures of the guys on the motorcycle. And then later on, when I was working for a mining company, let me back up a minute. Back in Platteville, I was working part-time for a local mining company. One thing that was interesting about Platteville was that it was the oldest continuously mined metal district in the country up until maybe the mid-70s or so. It was a lead-zinc district. And there was a company there called New Jersey Zinc that I was working for. I did surveying for them and one thing or another. And they called me in the office one day and said, I understand you're interested in photography. Yeah. So, well, we've got a project for you. And they had drill cores, these rock, they're about, maybe 2 inches in diameter, inch and a half, and came in boxes about 4 feet long, and there was a whole bunch of them in a box. They had a mite big exploration project going in northern Wisconsin. They bought this down, and they wanted me to photograph them all. So they had a setup there where I would get up above it, and I had lighting, and it. When you take pictures of something like that, you have to have a spray bottle of water to wet it down so the texture of the rock comes out.
Right.
So I spent a lot of time doing that. And then as I worked out west, I was working for a Canadian mining company out there in the Sierras, taking pictures up in the mountains and everything, mostly for my own enjoyment. You know, I was always kind of interested in landscape work, and out there the landscape was pretty dramatic, and you'd go over to the coast, and in California, in Nevada, you know, you didn't have to go very far before you were in a totally different kind of environment, from desert to mountains to farmland to whatever. And then eventually wound up back here in Michigan City, took a job with a local company that was working with construction aggregates, mineral aggregates, and I was involved in the testing and exploration for those kind of things, and took pictures for them. Was doing microscope work. We were doing special like glass counts of different kinds of materials to find out what percentage of like quartz glass was in it. So taking pictures through a microscope, I got that. Oh, I forgot to mention, when I was a young kid, I was also interested in astronomy. So a friend of mine and myself, we would be out in the yard and trying to cobble up camera attachments for the telescopes and stuff, which was always a challenge.
Yeah.
So I've taken pictures of everything from through a telescope to through a microscope, then everything in between. So long story short, years later here, we have a couple kids, and they finally both graduated from high school. They were out 4 years apart, so one's in college and one just graduated from high school then. And Connie and I looked at each other and said, well, what do we do now? You know, everybody's gone, just us. So we decided to go back to graduate school. And Connie had a degree. I had met her at Platteville, and she had a degree in painting. So she went back to, we met Governor State University over in Illinois, and she got her master's in art and painting, and I got my master's in art and photography. So I've been doing more fine art type photography since then.
What a nice thing to do together.
Yeah, it's really wonderful to have an interest like that outside of, you know, the home things that you both love to do. So we've been doing that together for many years now. And then as we went on, I got interested in teaching, and some part-time teaching jobs came up, adjunct teaching with Prairie State College over in Illinois. And I started teaching art appreciation there. And then I took some art, taught some art history classes. And then all of a sudden they needed somebody to teach history of photography. I said, okay. So I started doing that. And that really got me interested in the historical aspect of photography, which I had never spent much time on before. And I became fascinated with the work that the early pioneers did, and especially photographers of the 60s and 70s, things that they did. And that's where I came across this particular artistic movement that started in about 75, called the New Topographic Movement. And it was a new approach to landscape photography, in which you took a look at the landscape from the aspect of man's impact on it. You know, typically when you go out to take a picture of some kind of landscape scene, you kind of move around, and maybe there's a power line over here, or a trash can over here. So you position yourself so that that's not in. But with this, you include that, because that is now part of the environment. You know, there's a scientific characterization of modern times called the Anthropocene that started about 1945. And since that time, man has been the major influencer on the climate and the landscape. So this movement started showing that, and it was started mainly by a guy by the name of Robert Adams, no relation to Ansel Adams. And he put together this exhibit. There was about eight of the guys. But that movement kind of continues, and it takes a look at how the environment has changed with respect to the impact of man. Man has developed these different areas. There's been urbanization, highways built, utilities, you know, access developed, access restricted, landscape changed. It's no longer just you know,
no longer just nature.
No longer just nature. Now man has got a major effect in it. So I took an interest in that because I was having trouble around this area finding a good vantage point for a number of shots because all these other things kept getting in the way. So I said, well, I'm just going to include them and started out doing that. And I put together a small body of work and I'm continuing with that. Some of my first attempts are on this website that I mentioned to you earlier. And you can see some of that. I made a zine lately with a lot of those pictures in. It was on exhibit over in at the Chesterton Arts Center not long ago. And I'm continuing with that work. I just find it very rewarding. Well, since teaching the history of photography, I've got more and more interested in the documentary aspect of photography. So I'm kind of pursuing that. So that's kind of where I am now. Retired now. Still doing, you know, photography stuff, though.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
So with this, are you mostly shooting black and white, or are these landscapes in color, or are they both?
Well, back in about, the quick answer is black and white. Back in about 2015, I started reevaluating everything I was doing in photography, from the equipment I was using to the subject matter to the processing, printing, everything. And I made some major changes in things. And one of those changes was I was going to shoot in black and white. And that's really all I do right now. Well, I shouldn't say all. On occasion, I'll shoot color if color is important for something. But most of the time, it's black and white. I like focusing on the light and the texture and the forms, all those kind of things that are in the picture, and not letting color sort of be a distraction in a way from what I'm trying to show.
Yeah, color can be a distractive element by doing black and white. So I'm looking at two websites, your castle-studio.com, which you share with your wife, Connie, and your work there. And you see some of the other things like textured images, florals, and some of the other things. And I don't know if that's some of your older work, but maybe discuss of that earlier work before you got into, and it's a separate website, of course, is georgecastlephotos.com. And all the ones you have up there in the man-altered landscapes, those are all rendered in black and white. It looks like very slightly sepia-toned or toned a little bit.
Might be. if it is, I think it's mainly just, a distortion in the imagery on the computer because I really didn't add anything.
Right. How do you find the subjects? I mean, I'm looking at one of them, and I recognize it. It's the Washington Park Beach, but it's just cars with the dunes in the background, it looks like.
Connie and I tend to take little trips on a weekend and not, you know, just during the day, a couple hours. We'll go out, we'll take the dog and we'll find a local park and walk around a little bit maybe. And I'll take pictures. Most of my pictures are taken walking around and I've got the dog on a leash in one hand and I'm shooting this in one hand, you know, with the other hand. So it's just scenes from around here. That parking lot actually is Warren Dunes in Michigan.
Oh, okay.
It does look somewhat similar.
It sure does. Yeah.
Yeah. But there is a Washington Park one in there, I believe. But, you know, I'm just trying to look at what's around me. I don't travel to exotic parks anywhere or look for special things. I just look at what's around me.
Sure. Yeah, they're very simple, and yet they show the impact of, they can be like power lines on a hillside or a burn a bin. I know in one of the things, a section in my website I use is I call nostalgic structures, which is similar to what you do, not necessarily in black and white, where there are images of things that may be from the past or current, but they kind of are retro and everything, so it is so. For our photographer friends out there, what kind of equipment are you shooting with now?
I shoot with pretty simple setup. I have a Fuji mirrorless rangefinder style APS-C camera.
Okay.
And I shoot almost everything with a prime lens. It's the 18mm f2 lens, which in 35mm equivalent is about 27mm.
Right.
So I try to shoot everything with this. Occasionally I use a 35, but I try to do everything in the same lens I abandon using zoom lenses, telephoto lenses, anything like that. I have two lenses basically, and most everything is shot with the 18. When you do that, you get used to looking at things from a certain perspective. You're not, and that's one less thing to fool around with is the zoom, right, trying to hunt around. And it keeps it, if I'm going to publish it, and I like doing it in zines, I'm working on a book and all those things. And if it's in the same viewpoint, it has a unity that you don't get if every other picture is a different format and a different focal length and whatever. So I like keeping that constant thing. I don't carry stuff around with me. The most I carry is a camera strap around my neck and a little envelope in my pocket that has an extra battery or two and an extra memory card. That's all I carry.
That's so neat because it really just keeps you, I mean, you really know what your limits are and what you're looking for. And it just really eliminates so much other, I don't know. I mean, I think you can be very specific that way.
Yeah, I don't want to let the camera and all the gear get in the way of me taking the picture. It's just a tool for me.
Right.
So, George, what is your next step, do you think? What are your next projects or directions you're thinking about?
Well, I usually work in terms of a project, of a theme, of a subject matter. And when I go out, I look for those things. I used to go out and take random pictures of things and just collect pictures of different interesting things and try to find something to do with them later. Now I'm working specifically at specific things. And what I want to do is refine that work that I started with, take more of that, and possibly put it into a book. I've started working on this, and it just takes a little more work, that's all. So I'm interested in publishing things more than exhibiting, really. I'm interested in publishing it in either zine form or book form.
Now, your post-processing, it looks like, I don't know if you do much post-processing. You have to, with digital, you have to do at least some if you're shooting like in RAW or things like that. But tell us maybe about your workflow for that.
Okay, here's another thing that I do that most photographers will say, what the heck are you doing? I shoot all in JPEG. I don't
really
shoot any RAW, and I do a minimum of processing. Whatever I do in Lightroom.
Okay.
Occasionally, I might throw it out into SilverFX Pro or something for some specific reason, but for the most part, all that is minimal. When I take it, I don't really crop much. Maybe a little bit if something has to be straightened. And other than maybe adjusting the exposure a little bit if I have to, but it's pretty much straightforward.
Yeah.
I noticed you had that book on First Fridays. Do you have other books out, George?
Oh, yeah. I've got probably 8 different zines out. I just had one on exhibit in that Chesterton exhibit for, what was it, Art of the Written Word or something like that.
Are they available? Do you have them available someplace?
I don't right now. Matter of fact, I don't have any left. I have to have another printing.
I noticed the First Friday book is on Amazon.
Yeah, that was a pretty old project. I just got a bunch of invited a bunch of artists or whoever was attending the art exhibit to stand there for a simple portrait, black and white portrait on a white background, with some kind of expression, you know, and then put that in a book and also made like, I don't know, 11 by 14 prints or something and covered the whole wall with those just tacked up there.
So, fun.
When you say zines, but you're actually thinking of compiling a regular like bound book or something, even a soft cover, correct?
Right. The zines are pretty easy to get done and out because there's not that many images in it. A book might be a compilation of several of those put together that's refined a little bit, and the requirements are a little bit different sometimes for the book.
And do you editorialize, like write something about each of the images, maybe like what it was, and not just a caption, but maybe something about it that goes along with the picture?
Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. There'll be an introduction at the beginning of these zines, for example, that explain what this is all about. What are these pictures for? Why did I take them? Why might you be interested in them? That kind of a thing. And then sometimes I'll include some additional descriptive information with each photo, kind of a caption. another way of describing some of this work is it's been called the aesthetics of the liminal space. And that refers to the space in between, like where your starting point is and where your destination is. En route, you pass by certain things and you tend to ignore those. And what I'm doing is taking those things and putting them out there for people to look at.
Well, we only have about a minute left here, George. We want people to know where they can find you. I know you have two websites, one with Connie and that new standalone, so they can find your work and how they get in touch with you.
Well, I can be reached. The email is george@castlestudio.com. That's one way, castle-studio.com. And that's K-A-S-S-A-L dash, like a minus sign, studio.com. And castlestudio.com is one of these websites where Connie and I both have some work. They're both kind of older work at this point. I'm putting together a whole revision of that. The other one, which was georgecastlephotography.com, www, has got some of this recent work in it. Please just send me an email or get me on Facebook, George Castle. I'm there.
Okay. We appreciate coming back on Art in the Air after it's about almost 3 years. It's George Castle, photographer working on new projects about man-altered landscaping, and you can find his work on those websites. George, thank you again for coming on Art on the Air.
Thank you so much, George.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at LakeshorePublicRadio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Art in the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker, and for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art on the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good, and you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.